Welcoming today Louise Doughty, who's a novelist, playwright and critic. She's also the author of six novels, Crazy Paving, Dance With Me, Honeydew, Fires in the Dark, Stone Cradle, and the recently published Whatever You Love, which was longlisted for the Orange Prize for Fiction and shortlisted for the Costa Novel Prize. Louise has also written one work of non-fiction, A Novel in a Year. She's written five plays for radio and worked widely as a critic and broadcaster in the UK where she lives, and was a judge for the 2008 Man Booker Prize for Fiction. Welcome, Louise. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. It's nice to be here.
I know, of course, that you started out as a writer, well, perhaps way before you began with the MA in Creative Writing at UEA. Since then, you've published seven novels and a non-fiction book, and also had a career as a journalist and a teacher of creative writing. It's a very, very full career, and I just wondered whether you had a sense of what has helped you to kind of to have such a broad range of work, effectively. What's the secret of your success as a writer?
Well, I think the broad range question is very interesting. I think that really you have to have a broad range or a broad portfolio, you might call it, if you want to earn a living as a writer. And I think that's something that I realized very early on, or I was lucky enough to realize early on, which is there's a huge difference between publishing a novel, which is hard enough as it is, but then having a sustained career as a full-time professional writer is sort of quite a different thing, really. And there are writers who are able to just publish novels, you know, if they have income from other means. But I always knew that I would have to support myself by my writing. And so I suppose I was quite cold-blooded about it. I always wanted to do some journalism as well. I always wanted to do broadcasting. I write radio plays. I do writing-related teaching. And I think it was just very important to me to feel like a professional. I don't think I would have been happy as a writer if I'd, say, worked 3 days a week at something else and then just published a novel every few years. It really mattered to me that I was putting food on the table with the writing. I think that probably comes out of a sort of Protestant work ethic that I was brought up with. But I think getting that distinction in your head early on is really useful. I mean, another way of putting it is, what is the relationship between your writing and money? You know, do you actually want to earn a living at this game? In which case, you do have to be incredibly hard-nosed and do lots and lots of other activities related to novel writing and have a very broad portfolio. Mm. Or is it just the question of working on the novel alone? In which case, I think you probably have more freedom.
There is somebody, because we're talking here to people who are, for the most part, serious about their writing, but at a relatively early stage in their writing careers. Mm. Do you have any specific advice for those people who are at that stage, who perhaps don't yet have the security of knowing that their novel, for example, will be published and will give them an income? Do you think it's better to, in their writing, to solely focus on their novel writing or their nonfiction books? Or do you think even at an early stage people should be looking to broaden that portfolio?
I think it depends what you want long term. I mean, if you have enough time to also try to get book reviewing work and all that sort of stuff, that's great. But I think really in the early stages, I guess concentrating on the book is the best idea. But in a way, many things flow from that. I mean, once you've published a novel, it is much easier to do things like get book reviewing. And also you have a publicist with a publisher who might help you get journalism. And I suppose the danger is that if you spend too much of your early career doing all those other things, you can dissipate the energies that should be going into the books. But I suppose what I would say to anybody is you have got to be realistic. I mean, even when a novel is published, the average advance for a first novel is about £7,000 or £8,000 at the moment. And if that's something that's taken you 4 years to write, you know, you can do the maths. It's even published novelists, it's very, very hard to earn a living from their novels alone. Mm-hmm. So I just think it's useful to be really businesslike and hard-nosed with yourself and say, well, even when the book is published, I'm still going to have to do other stuff. Is that going to come from a different job or writing-related jobs? And I think being businesslike is a great plus, and it helps you to be a better writer, I think. It helps you to take a more hard-nosed and distanced approach to the work.
And what about, I'm just sort of thinking about the sort of the focus that people need at that stage as well. Obviously, again, a lot of people on the call are already perhaps in a coaching relationship, or they are a member of something like the Completion Club. You and I have both done amazing creative writing. I know that some people listening to this are actually considering doing an MA in creative writing, and I wonder whether that's something that you would recommend.
I'm a great believer in courses. I mean, an MA is fantastic if you can do it, because obviously it means dedicating yourself to the writing full time for a year. But any sort of course, you know, whether it's an MA or something like the Completion Club or the Faber courses or anything, I think anything that gives you a formal structure is a huge help. For a start, I think if you invest something in a course, whether it's time or money or probably both, then it gives you permission to take yourself seriously as a writer. You know, if you've paid money and made a lot of sacrifices to do something, then you really do have an impetus to make the most of it. But also, I think any structure is helpful. If you have to write 3,000 words to submit to a group, you damn well sit down and write 3,000 words in a way that you don't if you're just doing it for yourself. And you have a support network. I still have writing friends, you know, that I made at UEA 25 years ago. And in fact, my closest friends are writing friends that I've made through courses. And I think, in a way, you know, I mean, my line on courses is that writers have always banded together to help each other out, you know, throughout literary history. And I would say, what was Virginia Woolf and all the rest up to? You know, it was just a kind of MA in course with trust funds on top, you know. And whether it's sitting around in coffee houses in the 18th century, you know, writers have always needed to form groups for a mutual support network, because the nature of the activity is that it's solitary and you have to form those networks, sometimes in quite an artificial way. And so writing courses of any sort, I think, are just putting a formal structure on what writers have always done. And, I mean, I've found them completely invaluable, so I'm a great believer in them.
Thank you. And, of course, we would never have met were it not for them.
Absolutely. No.
Let's talk about your work for a bit now. You have covered sort of hugely sort of broad ground in your novels, from the death of a child to even, you know, the Holocaust. You know, you've looked into your family history. You've also done much lighter sort of kind of a love story or more of a comic novel earlier on. Do you think there's a unifying theme that runs through everything you do, or several themes?
There are, but I think they're pretty well buried. I mean, I think it's arguably a bit of a handicap to be doing something different with each novel, which I've certainly done. And I think as writers, we tend to think we must break new ground with each book. And actually, of course, what the publishing industry wants is more of the same each time, particularly if you've been successful. But I think if there are underlying themes in my work, I think one underlying theme I've realized is accident and circumstance, and people being controlled by fate, if you like, or random events. And that goes right back to my first novel, Crazy Paving, which was very loosely based on chaos theory. I think another theme is the whole idea of people being morally ambiguous. I've realized over the years that's something that fascinates me. I mean, Laura in Whatever You Love is somebody you ideally feel huge sympathy for at the beginning of the book, because she's lost a child, but then her behavior becomes more and more morally dubious throughout the book. And I think the idea behind that was you were forced to confront whether or not you would behave like her in those circumstances. Mm. And even in Fires in the Dark, my main character actually murders an old couple at one point in the book. And some people found that very hard to take and found they lost sympathy with him. But actually, he's on the run from a concentration camp. He's been exhorted to survive by his mother as the last surviving member of his family, and killing the old couple in the woods is the only way he's going to survive. Otherwise, he's going to starve. And I, having done a lot of reading about the events of the Second World War and what people went through, had no doubt that in those circumstances I was capable of behaving like that, and that a lot of people who think they could never behave like that are capable of behaving like that. And in fact, a lot of people did behave like that. I suppose that idea of taking an ostensibly ordinary person and putting them in a situation of extremis and seeing, let's kind of really twist this person by random events and see what happens to them, see what they do.
It's interesting actually to hear you talk about research actually, because I was thinking about, I'm aware that you've done some work based on family history, you know, but there's a lot about, a lot of people say, write what you know. I remember reading an essay by Graham Swift in what he says, for God's sake, write what you don't know, else how will your imagination come into play?
Yeah.
But funnily enough, I've been looking at Andrew Cohen's book that he's just brought out called The Art of Fiction, and he talks a lot about writing from observation and what you know, and I wondered where you stand in that debate.
Well, that's a really interesting question, isn't it? I get asked that a lot. I'm sure you do too. In a way, I think it's a false question because I think you have to define your terms. When people say write about what you know, what they often mean is if you're a criminologist, you should write a novel about criminal pathology. But actually, of course, what we know is much broader than that. It's often what we know emotionally. You can have an emotional understanding of a situation even if it hasn't happened to you. Or if you have a close family member who's gone something, you will know it in a way that a stranger to that person wouldn't know it. You can always go and find out facts. If you want to set a novel in Alaska and you've never been to Alaska, you can either get on a plane there, or if you can't afford to, you can go online and find everything you need to know about Alaska. If you want to know what it's like when one of your toes starts to freeze, you know, you can find that out in Milton Keynes during a bad winter, and you can apply that to Alaska. So in a way, I think it's a false question, because I think personal experience has to only ever be the starting point. But obviously without the starting point, you know, it's very hard to get started. But I think there does come a point where every novelist has to be prepared to take an imaginative leap. Otherwise, you simply run out of things that are interesting about yourself.
Yeah.
And I suppose the danger of sticking to writing what you know is your fiction then becomes memoir, and you find it very hard to edit, and you find it very hard to let go of your perceived truth of a particular event.
Mm-hmm.
And in actual fact, I'm with Malcolm Bradbury. When I started the MA, he said very sternly to our class, and it's something I repeat at the beginning of every class I teach, he said, the excuse I least like to hear in this class is, it really was like that.
Right.
Because it doesn't matter whether it really was like that for you.
Yeah.
The point is, have you made it convincing, coherent, imaginative, real within the terms of reference of the novel you're writing?
Mm.
The fact that you really did feel like that yourself when something similar happened is never an excuse when you're writing a work of fiction. So if anything, I tend towards using your imagination. Having said that, I think, and I'm sure you feel this too, when you know people intimately and they happen to be writers and you read their novels, you can see them in almost every line.
Yeah.
I mean, and the really scary thing is you can see people's personality flaws are quite often very closely related to the flaws in their fiction, which is a really scary thought.
Particularly scary if you and I have read one another's novels so
closely. Yes, it's extremely scary.
But we're still talking, so.
Yes, that must be good.
I was kind of interested just to sort of hear you talk about that sense of sort of what makes a novel real and what makes it come alive. And I'm thinking about those students as well that you've taught. Do you ever get that sense when you're teaching or looking at students' work, or even not necessarily just their work, but also their attitude to their writing and their writing career? Do you have a sense of who's going to kind of make it, if we want to talk in those kind of success kind of terms, in terms of what kind of a writer is most likely to break through, or what kind of, what needs to be in the work for that work to break through into the
marketplace? I can certainly make a massive generalization on the basis of personality type, which is, the writers who are most humble tend to be the ones who I think are going to come through eventually, because they are the ones who have a very acute sense of just how much they have to learn.
Right.
and the writers who kind of swagger in, and I'm going to make another massive generalization here and say they're normally blokes, but the ones who come in with a real sense of entitlement, mm-hmm. thinking they are Kafka or Joyce or Ian McEwan or whatever, and the industry is just idiotic because it hasn't recognized it yet, and there's some sort of conspiracy against them, and that's why it's been published. Those ones are often, I'm sorry to say, quite often the least talented in a group. But they're the ones who don't improve during a course because they don't really understand how much there is still to learn. Even if you are hugely talented, there's an enormous amount still to learn. And it's the students who come in and sit there and say, I'm having real difficulty with this novel. I don't know where it's going. I don't know if I should be doing this at all. And then you read their work, you go, wow. And I really believe that it's all about knowing just how much you have to learn, just how hard you're going to have to work, how much you're going to have to be prepared to change your work, to listen to criticism, to rewrite endlessly if necessary, to have extraordinary amount of emotional stamina. You know, those are the students. I think it's sort of a bit of a tortoise and hare situation. You know, those are the tortoises who are going to come through eventually, and I do believe that.
It's a really interesting observation, actually, and I can think of lots of instances in which that makes sense to me, actually. I'm constantly amazed at quite, you know, a lot of people I work with, at how humble they are and how uncertain they are when they're doing such wonderful work a lot of the time. And I was wondering, when you talked about how much there is still to learn, do you feel as if you're still learning?
Oh, yes. Oh, crumbs, yes. I mean, I think if you ever reach a point where you think you've nothing to learn, that's the point at which you stop. I mean, I constantly feel that the next book I'm going to write is going to be better than all the others, and that now maybe I finally know enough to make it better than all the others. And the minute it's published, I'm thinking, I can't believe I did X, Y, Z, and how could I have let that go? And, oh, I really got that wrong. And next one, I'll get it right. And I do think that I feel I've got better novels in me than the ones I've written, or I hope I have. And I want to sort of go out and find those novels.
And yet, it's interesting, you know, your recent novel is the novel that's sort of had, you know, a lot of accolades with this, you know, being longlisted for the Orange Prize and shortlisted for the Costa Novel Prize. Do you think that has affected your self-perception as a writer?
Well, that's an interesting one, has it? The bizarre thing is that when a novel is shortlisted for a prize, it doesn't make it any better a novel, and you know that because you wrote it 2 years ago. And suddenly, I know when I got shortlisted for the Costa, I had lots of lovely, lovely emails from friends, very generous, often from writer friends who had published a novel themselves that year and might legitimately have hoped to have been shortlisted, really generous, saying, you know, congratulations. And it was lovely, but part of me did think, well, why am I being congratulated? Because it's exactly the same book as it was 24 hours ago. I haven't actually done anything. You know, I've just had a huge bit of luck, enormous bit of luck. And
not
I think
deserved, of course.
Yes, but it would have been deserved even if I hadn't got it, I hope, if you see what I mean. You know, it's just like, I mean, do you congratulate somebody on winning the lottery, you know, because all they've done is bought the ticket? And literary prizes are lotteries. I mean, writing the novel is obviously not. That's about talent and persistence and all the rest of it. But the actual being shortlisted for a prize is nothing but luck. I do believe that. There were something like 160 novels entered for the Costa, and there were four on the shortlist. I don't believe for a minute that in the remaining 156 there were not a lot of novels that were much better than mine. It's just mine was lucky.
But then all 160 were probably very, well, maybe most of the 160 were probably very deserving to have got that far, shall we say. So it's not just luck, it's talent too.
Yeah, I know. But it is, I think in a way you become most cynical about prizes when you get shortlisted for them. I mean, when you don't put a sniff of them, that's when you start to think, if only I was longlisted or shortlisted, I'd be happy. And then the minute you are, you move the goalposts on yourself and you think, well, actually, it was luck. And we all know that the judging panels of these prizes changes every time, and a different judging panel would have come up with a completely different shortlist. So, you know, I think That's in a way one of the nicest things about being shortlisted for these things, is it makes you very philosophical. Well, anyway, wait until I publish the next novel. Come back to me then and let's see how philosophical I am then, shall we?
Sure, look forward to it. Good. All right, well, I've got a few questions. We'll bring in some of the club members in a minute to ask questions, but I've got a few that people who couldn't attend the call have asked me to put to you as well. And because some people are coming towards the end of novels in particular, one person's asked me to ask you how you would approach the second draft of a novel. When you have your first draft
down. My first question would be, have you had enough of a break from it, the first draft, I mean? I know that certainly it's absolutely crucial for me to have a really decent break before going into the second draft. For a start, my brain is dead by the end of the first draft, and I'm emotionally exhausted by the book, and I'm often really quite sick of it by then. Mm. And also, I think something that's really healthy, if you can try before you go into your second draft, is to start something else, even if it's just a short story, or have a go at a radio play, or make a few notes. Novel, because I think then you start to emotionally invest in the next book, the next thing you're going to write, and it really does help you be more ruthless when it comes to rewriting, because I think then it's easier to detach your ego from that first draft, because when it comes to rewriting, you've got to rewrite with your intellect instead of your ego, and you've got to let go of all that emotional investment that you probably had to make in order to get that first draft out. Mm. And you've got to be very cold-blooded and step back from it. And sometimes you've got to edit out huge chunks of really good writing for the good of the novel as a whole, because they didn't fit in some way or they slowed the plot down. I mean, I lifted out a scene wholesale from Whatever You Love, which was actually a really good scene with Laura sitting in the waiting room of a dentist's and meeting a complete stranger and then coming to the realization that the stranger had had an affair with her husband. Mm. And it was a really nice little vignette, but there wasn't a place for it. Where I'd written it, it just slowed everything down, and it just had to go, it had to come out. And I would never have been able to do that if I'd gone straight into my second draft. I needed the detachment from the book in order to be able to make that decision.
And I suppose it also gives you that sense of what's going to be beyond the novel, possibly, as well. Mm. I suppose it depends what comes up in that gap.
Yes.
Is there the other question that was asked around that, is there a point at which you know that you have finished? How do you stop yourself from endlessly tinkering? Is there a point at which you can say enough is enough?
I think if you find yourself making very small changes, then changing them back again and looking at them, you know, things like taking a word out, then putting it back in again. When you get to that kind of tiny line-by-line tinkering, you know, you're probably done. And also, if you get to the point, which we all get to eventually, where you just can't see the wood for the trees anymore, you know, maybe it may be that you've not finished rewriting, but it may be that's the point at which you need external help. You know, you have a break for it, or you get someone else to read the manuscript, preferably several people to read the manuscript, because I think that there just does come a point where, you know, we all need help. There are things that people can spot that you can't, just because you're so tired and you've been over it again and again and again. I'm just currently re-editing Whatever You Love for the American version. They are Americanizing it. So my the small boy in it doesn't have an ice lolly, he has a popsicle.
Gosh.
And they don't go to the pub and have beer and chips, they have beer and fries, and it's all that sort of thing.
Wow.
And all the spelling's being changed. What's very odd is that the characters all still live in a small seaside town on the south coast of England.
Right, yes, I was wondering. They're not moving it to San Francisco.
It's all light edits, but it does mean it, particularly because it's a first person, you know, narrative, you know, suddenly it sounds a bit as though Laura has an American accent, but she's still a physiotherapist living on the south coast.
So you have to do that yourself, do you, American?
Well, they did it. They did it, and then they've sent it to me for my approval.
Right.
I mean, approval in inverted commas, I think that is. But they were very tentative about asking me. They said, we feel we should Americanize it. Is that okay with you? And I mean, I know some people do object to it and find it really difficult, but I don't really. I think if it's going to be published in America, if that's what it needs, you know, they're the experts. But even, I suppose the point is making, even going through the manuscript, checking the Americanizations, I have spotted things that were missed in the original manuscript.
Oh, hello.
Oh, hello. Sorry about that, everybody. I did... Is everyone still with you? I did explain to Jackie beforehand that my useless cordless phone at home would likely die on me in the middle of it, so I'm really sorry about that.
We got a very dramatic noise, which
sounded like I was disappearing down the plug hole or
excellent.
Something.
Thank you. Thanks for coming back. Anyway, I'm trying to remember where we were. When
I was, yes, I was about to come to the end of a slightly long-winded point, which was that looking through the manuscript for the process of Americanization,
yeah.
I am spotting things
in
the original text that have been missed by everybody, by me endlessly rewriting, by my publisher, by several translators. You know, there's always something that you spot after a break or you get help.
It is quite amazing, actually, isn't it, every time you come back that you see something like that, absolutely. All right, well... I'm wondering, I've got a couple more questions, but I'm actually wondering whether to open it up to the floor. I think maybe just one other thing perhaps we'll touch on before I open it for questions to everybody is just that sense, because I know it's something that people I work with often talk about, is just that sense of how to be productive effectively in your writing life. And I know in the past you talked about being a marathon writer, that you kind of have your sort of long days that you work, but you don't write every day. I know you spoke to me recently that might be changing and shifting, but do you have any advice for other people on, just really on terms of what has worked for you in terms of remaining productive as a writer, but also juggling writing with the rest of life?
Yes, I mean, that is the big question really, isn't it? I think my big advice now at this particular stage would be stay flexible, in the sense that for years and years, as you rightly say, I've sort of thought of myself as a writer who, a sort of a binge writer, who wrote in these big splurges, quite often nothing for weeks, and then a great long 10-hour day when I'd write thousands of words. And for years and years, I've said to everybody, that's just the way I do it. I couldn't do it any other way. And it reached the point where that was just becoming untenable for a combination of factors. I mean, partly just sort of domestic things, having to do the school run on certain days and other work I had to do. So I thought, well, just as an experiment, I'm going to try and make myself into the writer who does it sort of straight after breakfast in two-hour chunks. And turn myself into a morning writer, who's the kind of writer I've always envied, because then you do your bit and then you're done. And so far, it's working reasonably well. I mean, I still don't do it every day, and I just can't because of other deadlines that come in. But what I am doing is doing the school run with my laptop and then going straight to a cafe, not coming home, and crucially for me, not opening my email. I mean, that's what really finishes my day if I open the email. And just sitting in the cafe, and I'll do about 2 hours, and in that time I'll quite often write between 1,000 and 2,000 words. And at the moment, I'm doing that a couple of times a week. So my current regime, because I'm on a deadline now for the next book for Faber, but my current regime is 3,000 words a week. And I find that a couple of sessions like that generally tends to do it. And if I can keep that up, I'll be up to 60,000 by the end of the school term. And then hopefully next term when the kids are at school, I'll be able to do another 30, so I'll have my first draft done by the end of the year.
It's fascinating, isn't it, sort of listening in, because it's that, I think people have that sense that if you are sort of publishing as much as you are, then you must be doing nothing else other than sitting at your desk.
I wish.
Writing full time. I know, in our dreams, you know, but it's the fact to know that actually, you know, that you can do it in 4 hours a week and to be as productive as you can. And I know, obviously, it hasn't always been like that. There have been some times where, you know, as you say, you've done 10 hours once a fortnight, but it still adds up to about the same. But it's the regularity of it that it makes a difference, isn't it?
Yeah.
The keeping,
I think
keeping
so.
At it. Yeah.
Yeah. And also the sort of doggedness that... I mean, what I am able to do is what I call making the dog bark on command, in that I never have one of those sessions where I sit there and don't make some forward progress. I mean, occasionally there's a very bad one where I just do a bit of rewriting or tinkering or a couple of paragraphs. But almost always I sit down, I open up. If I don't want to write one particular scene, I just go and write another. But the thing I make sure I do at this stage, this crucial first draft stage, is just bang the words out, even if they're complete rubbish. Because I know I can fix it later. So I don't worry about how well I'm writing at all. I just think, right, I've got my quota to do. And as you say, I mean, I think if I get 4 hours a week, maybe on a good week I might get 6 hours a week. Yeah, that's more or less how I do it. That's more or less the amount of time out of the whole working life that I have to actually sort of be a novelist and do the first draft writing. The rest of the time is taken up with things like wondering if I can bear the word popsicle in my novel.
Well, on that note... All right. Thank you so much, Louise. I really appreciate your time. I'm going to bring in some of the other people on the line now. Does anybody else have a question that you want to put to Louise? Perhaps if you can just sort of say your name first so that we can know who's speaking, and then we'll dive into some more questions. Somebody be brave.
Everyone's going to try.
Otherwise, I have more.
Rowena, you must have a question.
Oh, but I've heard you on the
I know you've heard it, heard it all before. Yeah.
Well, not all of it, obviously. But I wanted to give others the opportunity to...
Okay.
But I have a question.
All right.
I was just... do you have a strategy? I've never asked you before whether you have a strategy if you actually get stuck, or is this ability to make the dog bark on command just something that you absolutely take for granted?
Yeah, I think my only strategy is that I never get hung up on one particular scene. So if I get to the thing that I think I'm going to write that morning, and for some reason it isn't there, I can't work out what the hell's going on, I don't know whether I really need the scene or any of those problems, I just drop it and write something else later in the novel. And I never let myself worry about the fact that I'm not writing the novel consecutively. I mean, the novel I'm on at the moment, I'm about halfway through my first draft. I've got about 43,000 words. I've already written the final scene. I just sat down one morning. I thought I was writing something in chapter 3. And you know what? Suddenly the final scene presented itself to me. I thought, I know, that would be a really good final scene. So I just dropped what I was doing and I went off and I wrote the final scene. And I'm doing it that way. What tends to happen is it means there are some scenes that you just put off and put off and put off until you can't put them off any longer. But what's really nice is occasionally you realize that actually the reason that scene was causing you such difficulty is you didn't really need it at all. And so instead of sort of wasting time stopping yourself writing because of the difficulty of that scene, you just think, hang on, I'm just going to skip that, or I'm going to write it in a completely different way.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that would be my main strategy for in terms of just getting the words on the page in the short amount of time I have, which is if some individual passage in your novel is causing you a problem, just move on. You know, maybe make a few notes about what happens in that scene and then just move on, write the next bit.
Yeah. Thank you.
Anybody else have a question for Louise?
Hi, it's the other Louise here.
Hi.
Hi, I just had a question, Louise, about when you're doing so many different projects, like book reviewing or judging a short story prize, for example, do you find it difficult to summon up enough mental and creative energy to work on your own fiction?
Yes, I really do, actually, and it's become an increasing problem over the years. I think as I've aged, I'm losing my ability to multitask, which is really scary, because I've always relied on that. I just, for the first time, really, I've just done a two-book deal with Faber, and the first time I've really realized I've just got to be more ruthless about saying no, and I've got a reasonably tight deadline. I've got to deliver in a year, and I only started this in January, so it's going to be 18 months from start to finish. And I have turned down everything in that period. Lots of little odds and ends that I would have liked to have done. There was a short story competition up in Yorkshire. I got asked to judge. I got asked to do the other couple of festivals I turned down. You know, odd little things like that, which none of those on their own should be novel-stopping things, but it's the cumulative effect of them, and particularly having a family at the same time, because obviously you never know what's going to get thrown at you then. You never know if one of the kids are going to be sick, or and we have builders in at the moment, I can assure you. That slows me down. But I find that the older I get, the more ruthless I have to get in order to get the writing done. And it's painful. I hate saying no to things. I really do. It's taken me years and years to get to the point where I can say no to something I want to do. And I do occasionally regret it. I do occasionally think, damn, I wish I'd taken that gig.
What about when you have taken a gig, Louise? That sense of, obviously at the moment, you've been brilliantly ruthless and you've been able to really focus. In those times when you have been multitasking more, is there anything else that has helped you to be able to kind of keep that focus, particularly when you are working, or making sure that you do put the time aside to do it in order to find focus?
Just getting the diary out and marking in writing days as if they were really important meetings, that's an important thing for me, is to sort of open the diary and look maybe 6 weeks ahead. And then actually write it in the diary, you know, a British Library Day or a research day, and then treat that in exactly the same way as I would any other unbreakable appointment.
Mm. It's the unbreakable part, isn't it? It's the fact that you don't then sort of say, oh, well, actually, it's only a writing day. It's like, no, this is very important and it must be on.
Yes. And quite often, you know, you can, if you've got two or three little things to do, just making sure that they all go on a day which is a mess anyway. So quite often I'll look at something and I realize I've got something in the morning, something in the afternoon. If I need to meet someone else for an hour, I'll do it on that day, and it might make that day really full. But rather than breaking up a writing day, yes, I think it's a question of corralling time, really. And actually writing it in your diary helps a lot for me, and sort of helps me mentally sort of put barbed wire around it.
Funnily enough, actually, I'm just sort of, I actually did an exercise over this past week, which I've never done before, and I actually kept a time log of everything I did for a whole week.
That's an interesting one.
I actually categorized it all and put it into pie charts last night, and I won't tell you the results, but it was very, very interesting. I might share them over a cup of coffee, but all I will say is it was fascinating to see where time was lost, and I said only mention it because that thing that you said about the sort of corralling time and putting things together is actually something that I don't think I'd done enough of, and by doing this exercise I realised how much time went in travelling back and forwards to seeing people or doing things, and so I found myself doing exactly what you've just suggested just this morning when I was suggesting a client meeting. It's that putting the two together, which I wouldn't normally do, but it actually saves time and brings back time into another day, and I don't think that's, you know, so thank you for that advice, which I could have done with before.
So how detailed was your time log? I mean, down to the
minute? Absolutely, it was down to about, I had half hour, 10, 15 minute chunks. It was, of course there were times, especially at the weekend, where, you know, there were long chunks where I might have been out or whatever, and sometimes I was catching up, but I was never longer than a day. During the working day, I was keeping it literally every 15 minutes, half an hour, so I could see where the time was going. And I have to say, it wasn't a typical week, but you still can look at that and you can get some interesting conclusions from it. In some ways, I wouldn't necessarily recommend it, because it became quite stressful that one felt as if one was always on some kind of timetable or deadline. But it was definitely a kind of an interesting exercise for sure. Anybody else got a question for Louise?
This is Catherine. I'd like to ask a question about, because you said at the beginning that you were a big advocate of courses and you teach on the Faber course. And I've always had in my head a sort of resistance to doing long courses like an MA, because I sort of think you might get stuck on a track and you want to focus on something and they want you to focus on something else. But I just wondered from your experience of teaching it whether you find that people can end up being in the wrong place at the wrong time on it, if you see what I mean.
Yes, I suppose timing is everything, really. I mean, I think that's a good point. I mean, you do need to do the courses at a time in your life for you. I mean, I did the MA, looking back on it now, I was ludicrously young when I did it. I did it, I think I went there when I was 22. And in some senses, the good thing about that was I had nothing to lose. I mean, I supported myself by working in bars. You know, I didn't have a family. But in another sense, I think it's an argument for saying that I was so young, I didn't get the most out of it. I just wasn't emotionally mature enough to really appreciate having a whole year writing. And I suppose it is important to think about when it's right for you and also what sort of course is right for you. I mean, an MA was right for me because I was fresh out of having done a BA and a university course was what sort of felt normal. But I think for a lot of people, a completely different sort of group might fit. I mean, I think doing what you feel, what your gut feeling is telling you is right for you is important.
Thank you.
Any other questions? In that case, I will ask one before we round up. I was just thinking, Louise, about the publishing climate in general at the moment and, you know, how much, you know, there's a lot of talk about being, you know, this challenging time and, you know, I've heard people say that, you know, it's quite a sort of icy time in the publishing world. I wondered how you perceive it, what changes you've noticed, or if you think, you know, we've heard a lot about how difficult things have become in publishing, whether you see any signs of a thaw at all.
It's very hard to say, really, because it's very hard for any individual writer to make generalizations, because obviously if an individual writer is having a bad time, the industry as a whole feels bad, and vice versa, I suppose. I mean, the one thing I would say, I know that all the publishers are obsessed with new media, with electronic publishing and all the rest of it at the moment. Book advances have definitely plummeted, even for really established, well-known authors. I mean, there was this phase in the 90s when, what one agent said to a friend of mine recently is 20 is the new 70. Neatly describing the 50 grand pay cut an established writer was supposed to take. And that a writer who legitimately might have expected, say, 80,000 for two books would now probably be very happy with 30,000 for two books. I mean, there's no doubt advances have plummeted. But, you know, that said, I mean, I've been publishing novels since 1995 now, and I cannot remember a year when publishers and agents haven't been saying to me, oh, things are so tough at the moment. Mm. Oh, it's difficult. Oh, we're dying on the bookstand. You know, they're all terrific eels. And they're all convinced that, you know, first of all, it was television was going to kill the novel. You know, now it's the internet or electronic publishing. I've been hearing that the novel is about to expire for two decades now. And people are still writing it and still publishing them and, you know, still finding readers, and the readers are there. So I take a slightly more optimistic view than most people. Mm. I think, you know, you write the novel that's in your heart, the one that you feel passionately about, and then you hope you're lucky. And that is actually no more and no less than writers have done for centuries, and that's all we can do. Mm. And I think if you think too much about the state of the industry, where it's all going, you can actually drive yourself nuts. You know, that's not your job as a writer. Your job as a writer is to write the book you want to write to the best of your ability. And then after that, you are in the laps of the gods, and there's nothing you can do about that. So why drive yourself crazy worrying about it?
Do you think people should think about genre when if they're at the beginning of a book?
No, I don't actually, because I think, I mean, obviously if you're writing something that's a specifically hardcore certain genre and you're going to sell it in that way, then presumably, I'm presuming that you're already very familiar with that genre, that you love reading it, that you believe in it, and that that's what interests and excites you. But I don't think that a writer should waste a lot of time at the beginning of their book thinking, hang on, how literary am I, how commercial am I, because ultimately that decision's not in your hands. When the publishers take your book on, they decide how they want to package it. And there's very little you can do about that. If they decide to put a pink stiletto on your book, because it's got a woman character who falls in love in it, and it doesn't matter whether you're writing, like, you know, Dostoevsky, if they decide the pink stiletto needs to go on because that's where the market is, that's what they'll do. Mm. And again, it's one of these things where if you start to worry about that too much in the process of writing, you can drive yourself nuts. And I just think you have to write the book you want to write the best of your ability, and that's it. There will come a time when all those issues come into play, when you're approaching agents, when the agent's approaching publishers, when people will turn around and say, well, hang on, are you the new Anne Enright, or are you the new, you know, whatever. But in the actual process of first draft writing, you know, just, you know, write whatever's in your heart to write. Otherwise, you will go mad. Mm. Trust me, you will.
And so we don't end on madness. What the final question for me? What draws you to your writing desk still, apart from the deadline and the contract,
the need to pay the building? I think I couldn't not do it. If I'm not working on a novel, I'm miserable and probably impossible to live with. I just feel an overwhelming and compulsive need to tell stories and to make up an imagined world and to people that world. And I don't really know where that comes from, but I do know that I could not have had a happy life if I hadn't done this. Mm. And that's completely separate from the issue of whether or not I have been lucky enough to publish it. I mean, there isn't a single day I don't thank my lucky stars I have been lucky enough to publish it. But I would still be doing this even if every single one of those novels had been turned down. I would still be working on a novel just because that's what I need to do. And as I said to someone the other day, it's better than bothering people on buses. So I just feel an overwhelming need to do it. And I think really, you know, that is all you need to give yourself permission to do it. If you need to do it, then, you know, you have a right to do it and you should go ahead and do it. The issue of publication, earning a living is a separate one. When it comes to the issue of writing, if you really need to do it and you find it satisfying, then you find time somehow and you do it.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's been really inspiring for me. I'm sure to everybody else on the line. Thank you for joining. Is there any last questions? It's your last chance to throw one in. All right.
No.
We'll leave it there. Thank you
so much,
Louise.
You're welcome. Good luck, everybody.
Have a lovely afternoon, and we will speak again. Take care.
All right. Thanks.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.